super sick.
Intercourse.
Condoms.
Sexually transmitted infections.
HIV.
STI.
HIV. Sexual health. Research.
Treatment.
Prevention.
Condoms.
Sexual attractive.
Sexually transmitted infection.
Contraceptive.
Sex education.
Sexual health
specialist.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the podcast. My name's Tom and this is the Sydney Sexual Health Centre podcast where we talk about all things related to sexual health. Today I will be speaking with Bronwyn Lees. She was the Senior Health Promotion Officer at the HIV and Related Programs Unit in the Nepean Blue Mountains Local Health District. She's been working in the sexual health and HIV sector since the 1980s, both in Australia and overseas. And she's recently retired from her full-time role. I invited her onto the podcast so she could share some of her stories and experiences over her career and talk about some of the changes she has witnessed. Thank you for coming along.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Sydney. I grew up in Manly. And in fact, the first thing I remember about sexuality education is being in year 11 at school and we had this science teacher, biology teacher, Miss Hemis, and she was incredibly, she didn't want to talk about sex or sexuality or anyway, it was the topic of reproduction. And so my friend Roberta and I got up and drew a penis and the reproductive system of a woman on the blackboard. And that was my very first memory of sexuality education because we didn't really have any in school at all. And we felt we had to teach the teacher about at least the sexual organs of men and women.
So. Okay. So you were doing sexual health education from a young age.
You've even got a photo of it still. I don't know how that happened. I think it was in the school magazine. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Must have raised some eyebrows.
Yeah. It's a funny memory.
And was sexual and reproductive health always something you were interested in?
Oh, I think so, but I think I kind of fell into it, really. Mm-hmm. I actually, when I finished school, I did early childhood education.
Yeah.
And worked in children's services in non-school settings. So I trained to teach, but didn't really work as a teacher. And then I travelled for a while. And when I came back, friends of mine were doing work with family planning as sessional educators on their schools program.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about that work is that family planning trained their own staff. So anyone with the right, I guess, right personal qualities could apply and possibly get positioned doing this sessional work in schools, and we were trained by family planning. I got the job and I loved it. I really enjoyed it and I found it really engaging, really interesting. I loved working with young people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really incredibly rewarding and I really liked working for the organisation. I liked their values. The work was incredibly interesting. The other people who worked there were really skilled and quite inspiring. So it was pre-HIV when I did the sessional work in schools.
And I guess a lot of those programs in the late 80s sound quite similar to what's still being run today. But you did mention there that this was pre-HIV.
Yeah.
But that must have had a big impact on the work that you were doing at the time.
Yes. I mean, I think a really big change around that, of course, was the issue of condom use. So condoms, when we were teaching, were really never, they were just prophylaxis for preventing pregnancy. They didn't have the role that we know now around preventing STIs. Of course, they had that role, but it wasn't promoted in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and safe sex wasn't spoken about in the same way either. So we did speak about it, but not in the way you would now.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the other issue is education around gender, and that was always spoken about. So especially in the sessions around values,
mm-hmm.
we would say up front that we were talking to them about sex and sexuality, and it didn't matter whether they were being sexual with another person or not yet, and it wouldn't matter what the gender of that person was.
Mm.
So that was always up front in the conversations. So they were very, I think for the times, they were very progressive conversations about sex and sexuality with young people. And certainly when I've met through different programs over time, I've met some people that went through those programs of family plannings and have spoken really positively about that experience for them. I first remember hearing about HIV in the early to mid 1980s and hearing about it as GRID. So then really all of that was changing in the time that I started to work at family planning. And certainly by the time I left in 1993, family planning was doing a lot more work in the HIV area, and all the foundational work that ACON had been established, and lots of foundational work had begun. There was a lot of research being done at Macquarie University with Sue Kippax and a team there. So, and you know, years on the what's now the Centre for Social Research in Health. But their early work was really groundbreaking, and it was the building, I think, of all that kind of social research that informed programs. So that, and of course the work on the ground by the gay community, I think they were the most significant changes. So community activation, but also research that was founded in the social aspects of sex and relationships, that made a significant difference. But also the conversations about sex that became much more explicit and much more sex positive. So I think in the work that we were doing at Family Planning, it was always sex positive, the conversation. But I think what HIV did was brought us to a much more explicit level in the conversations, very, very explicit around actual transmission and how to stay safe, and introducing much in a different kind of way the importance of pleasure in those conversations, as well as autonomy and decision-making. And
did you have much to do with ACON or other community-based organisations at the time?
Yeah, like I remember in the early 1990s having the first AIDS conference, which was ACON were really active, and other non-government organisations, people from what were then called Area Health Services were at that as well. It was in the Masonic Temple in Goulburn Street in the city, and it was a really great event actually. And so we also did a whole lot of project work with different non-government organisations at that point, but they were the early days of what was then called the AIDS Bureau in at the ministry. So it was really kind of AIDS specific. So the funding was AIDS specific. The funding at that point around HIV prevention really all came about through the numbers of people who actually were in hospital with HIV or AIDS defining illnesses.
We discussed that a lot of my knowledge of that time came from popular culture, books like Holding the Man by Timothy Congreve. And it turned out that she'd worked with Tim.
I worked with Tim on what became, I think it's now called Spark, ACON program. Then it was, what's it called?
Oh, Fun and Esteem.
Fun and Esteem. So, yeah, I worked with Tim, and also with when Fun and Esteem started, we did some work, I'm just trying to think what it was, using panel speakers. He did a specific project with us at Family Planning. So Family Planning did a lot. The NGOs did work together a lot at that point. So by the time I was involved with Tim Congreve and Fun and Esteem, I didn't do much with Fun and Esteem. I just remember doing a project with Tim. And I was working on the youth team at Family Planning as a full-time educator at that point. So, yeah. Tim died when I was in India. But I worked with him in the last year I was in Australia. He was gorgeous. Yeah. Have you read Holding the Man?
Yeah. I've seen
him
play in the film.
Yeah. The book, I think, shows what he's like. His death was terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, death of a young person is terrible. He was a lovely person.
Yeah.
Really, really lovely. Really clever, really creative. He was just great.
Yeah,
I really liked him a lot.
That period you went to India?
I went to India. So I think just that period of time that I worked full-time at Family Planning moved to Ashfield, and the work of the organisation changed a little bit during that time, and we broke into teams. So I worked for the youth team, and we did lots of really great work, but the schools program, the sessional schools program, ceased, and we were doing much more training. The focus was much more training education. So then I went to India to work as a volunteer through the Australian Volunteers Abroad program. And when I applied for the program, you just put your application in with your skills and work experience, and they make a decision about, they try and match people up, placements up with people volunteering. And I just imagined they would offer me women's health work in the Pacific because they would see Family Planning as that kind of work. I was a little bit worried they'd offer me HIV work and that I would find it a really difficult experience. I was worried that I might get sent to Africa or India. Anyway, they did offer me HIV work, and it was India. And prior to going, I did a little bit of research, which obviously wasn't on the internet because there was no such thing at that point. I checked in the library and found that Ken Davis, who worked at ACON, who I knew and had been to the organisation I was being placed with. So I contacted Ken and another friend, Paul Van Rijk, to find out about Ken's experience. And he was very positive about the organisation. So, and then before I went to work there, Paul and Ken put this whole South Indian evening on for me. So I was going to work in Madras, which is now called Chennai in South India. And I didn't know a lot about it. I knew that HIV was an important and growing issue there. But it's a Tamil speaking, it's in Tamil Nadu, so it's a Tamil speaking state and community. And they gave me learn Tamil in 30 days, and they played Indian movies for me, and they made me idli and dosa, and we had this fabulous night. So that was my first kind of little check-in about India, and I felt reassured by the conversation with Ken about the organisation I went to work with. I was there for about 3 years. The first 6 months was really just investigating how we might do the program. It was to be a youth-based program. It was to have two streams. One was going to be a structured program, and the other was what they called an unstructured program. So the structured program was about working with young people in schools. The unstructured program was about working in young people outside of school settings. So Franklin John Leader, who works in up on the North Coast, he did the unstructured program, and I worked in the structured program. In that part of South India, schools have what they call either Tamil medium or English medium schools, both languages, the dominating languages in that area, and so all the languages of choice. So I would work in the English medium schools, and as would the other English speaking Indian colleagues, and then the Tamil medium work would be done by the other colleagues that spoke Tamil as well as English. So I trained the staff, then we went into the schools and colleges, did this work, and then from those groups of students, those that were interested put their names down, and we did a 3-day peer education program with them. And then we supported them as peer educators to go back into other colleges. It wasn't really the schools program, but the college program. And they would then run activities. So we had Candlelight March. We did a quilt project. We had positive people talking about their lived experience, which was pretty unusual and difficult in India at that point.
Yeah, so it sounds like it was taking a lot of the things that were working really well in Australia and implementing them in a different setting.
Yeah, and it was really interesting doing that, because I think I had to go in and not know how that would work, or if it would work, or even how we'd do it. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of took everything I knew, both in terms of resources, physical resources, and the skills and experience I had in Sydney and Australia, and then worked with my colleagues there to explore what might work. That's why starting with training staff was really important, because it was about looking at the materials that we use to see how they might translate into that context. And actually, they translated really well. But I think it was very confronting, because you can't go into another culture believing or thinking that your way is the best or only way. And I think it's very easy to do that. It's actually very hard, in my experience anyway, it was very hard to go in and recognise that I was in a learning situation as well. Mm-hmm. And so that it was quite a journey, I think, for the first 6 months to kind of find my place and to not believe I was the expert, because we all brought different expertise into that process. So, and it was really important that the expertise be met equally, or as equally as possible.
And I suppose, how's that influenced your work when you returned to Sydney?
I think it was very difficult coming back from doing that work. It was very difficult to find a place to settle back into. Yeah. I think it was also difficult because the work was, it's really about HIV as a development issue. So when you leave a resource-rich country and go and work in a resource-poor country, it's very confronting around the difference. And this is a little aside, but I'll just use it as an example. So soon after getting to India, I was in a bus accident, a very bad bus accident. And one of the messages that was being spoken about at the time was, the blood banks then, people would be paid to donate blood. So the message that was being given out was, get family members to donate blood to you. So, of course, that's always assuming that everyone in your family is HIV negative. There was not this, you know, there's all these kind of assumptions that were embedded in that that would make people unsafe, people living with HIV in particular, because they'd be exposed in a way that, you know, or there was an expectation that they would be able to donate blood. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the context of the blood supply. So I had this very bad bus accident, was in this very bad blood accident, bus accident, and several people were killed, and some people just died on the road. It was the middle of the night, and I wasn't injured, but it was a really big confrontation for me anyway, but particularly about HIV as a development issue, because we then, by the time we were rescued, it was many hours later, people who might have been saved in Australia had died. People wouldn't stop for us in the night. There was really no help until the next day, and we were taken to a hospital. But so to see people die in situations where you knew they would be saved if it was in Australia, and to know that had they been given blood, there was a risk. If I'd needed blood, my desire to live would have been the one I would have gone with. I would have taken anyone's blood to survive. So I would have used blood that could have been contaminated. So I guess it was a really, I'm just trying to say that it was a very influential decision for me to stay at that point, because I was really struggling to be there. It was 3 months in and it was all really unfamiliar. But it also was a very big lesson about HIV as a development issue. Yeah. So,
and how it can affect.
Yeah. And poverty and the lack of infrastructure and the lack of resources and the resilience of people and the ability of people to do incredible things with very little resourcing, you know. It was really, yeah. And the creativeness that came from that, I think, as well. And I guess that's what we saw with the development of organisations like ACON and the kind of early campaigns and the project work that was done, that the resources weren't there initially, but people kind of banded together with their creative thinking and did this incredible work, this beautiful work that was really strong and radical and powerful in terms of its messaging and to bring about change. When I first came back from India, Graham Collier had been in the AIDS Bureau, and he'd been the education manager at Family Planning when I was there. Yeah. He then went and worked over for WHO in their HIV program, and Elizabeth O'Neill had worked there as well. So they were friends. So I knew about, when I came back to Australia, I worked at the Environment Protection Authority for 12 months. It was about the environment, but the work I did was really also about health, and Graham Collier's approach to health promotion was, in any context, that was one of the great things I think about working with him, that he could see the importance of the Ottawa Charter and its application across a whole lot of fields beyond health. So it was about healthy environment work. So the work I did was on waste minimisation. So it was composting and reuse, recycle. Yeah. So the kind of early days of all of that messaging about waste minimisation.
And you started in the late 80s. I mean, Ottawa Charter was 1986. Was that a very topical thing?
I didn't really hear about the Ottawa Charter until later than that. I didn't really hear the term health promotion until probably the 1990s, actually.
Yeah,
I think I first heard about it through Graham Collier, because he was engaged with that thinking through his work at WHO, probably.
Yep.
And Elizabeth also was engaged with the Ottawa Charter, so, and health promotion, and in particular sexual health promotion.
Another resource that you worked on is more around families and young people, so Talk Soon, Talk Often.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that one?
Yeah, I can. So Talk Soon, Talk Often is a really beautiful resource developed in Western Australia. So it was developed based on research that, again, La Trobe University had done. Jennifer Walsh from La Trobe, who was at La Trobe University at the time, did some research with parents in Western Australia about what they would like in a resource. So the West Australian government was incredibly progressive in developing Talk Soon, Talk Often. The resource was developed there. So in the research with parents, it was actually wasn't a very big piece of research, but in the research, what became apparent was that parents wanted a high quality resource that they could, not just a little brochure, they wanted a resource that they could refer to, that would tackle the tricky conversations, that would be about, would have age appropriate material in it, and would be something that they could keep and share. In when it came out, we were really excited by it because it was such a great resource and it was the only one of its kind. And it was a health, you know, Ministry of Health product. So we negotiated to have, with through the Ministry of Health here, with the Ministry of Health in Western Australia, to do an adaptation for New South Wales. So it was really encouraged by Elizabeth O'Neill, who was still the director of who is still the HIV-related programs manager. And I worked with other colleagues, with Louise Maher and a few other people, to make an adaptation for New South Wales. So what we'd undertaken was to purely adapt it for New South Wales. So we had to update the programmatic content, the legal content. Some other aspects of it we updated to. The main change were the photographs. We diversified the photographs that we used in their original version because they didn't feel representative of our communities. And since then, West Australia have redone the whole book, and it's actually a much better resource than it was even then. I think the part of the book that wasn't so good was the gender section. It was really lacking, and it was an area that we couldn't tackle given the commitment we've made and the time we had available. So we left the gender part intact as it was, but they've updated that and it's a much better resource for that work. Yeah. So we did that for all of New South Wales. However, we ended up distributing it across Nepean Blue Mountains through all the state schools there. It was also distributed through Hunter New England and through some schools in Western Sydney. So at that point, we were still with Western Sydney, and we separated out when the project was complete. So the main area that I then worked in on that project was Nepean Blue Mountains, and we worked in partnership with Family Planning to do a community-based approach. So the adaptation of the resource was one thing, but the distribution of the resource and follow-up support was probably even more important. By then, the resource was available online, the West Australian resource was available online, and by the halfway through the project, we'd managed to update our resource so it's available as a PDF online as well. But the original intention was to get the hard copy into families, into homes. So we worked through Department of Education, primary schools, to get the book to all primary schools who are interested. We offered support in the way of information nights for parents and teachers. We offered a parent program through the PNCs, and that was in partnership with Family Planning. We offered teacher training, and we offered just information they could include in the newsletter and tips on how to distribute the book. So the idea was there'd be enough copies of the book for every family in our local health district to have one go to them through their primary school if they had kids at primary school. We would give the book out at kindergarten orientation days. So that distribution went on in several iterations over quite a few years, still continues, but not through any more mail out.
Bronwyn was also developing some education material through the PlaySafe programs for use in schools. But this had to be paused due to the Safe Schools program.
But at the same time, that was 2017, there was the Safe Schools Coalition existed in Victoria, and the Safe Schools program was being rolled out in parts of Australia, including New South Wales. But the state government at the time in New South Wales pulled the Safe Schools program from state schools in New South Wales. And it meant that the work that we were looking to do for the PlaySafe program, schools program, was really not possible to continue with. There was too much opposition, too much controversy around sexuality work in schools. They wanted a low profile kept. There was great concern about how things might go if we progressed the program. Mm-hmm. So that's my memory of what happened. So we just shelved all the material we had developed ready to go. Yeah. And we left it, and then some years later went back to look at the second iteration. It was very controversial. Yeah. And it was a very sad time. So the Department of Education had a thing called Teaching Sexual Health. It had a website called Teaching Sexual Health. Yeah. And at the same time as we ceased the PlaySafe Schools program, they pulled the Department of Education, the Education Minister pulled that website. Mm-hmm. So the website was completely removed.
More recently, Bronwyn's work has focused on addressing stigma and discrimination.
So stigma and discrimination have always been a really difficult part of the work to tackle, and a really important thing to tackle. And stigma and discrimination always get brought up in all the strategies, in, you know, all the kind of roadblocks come to stigma and discrimination. So we had been trying to explore what we could do in the Pembloo Mountains to kind of make some inroads and to reach beyond the people who we always reach. And we recognised that running a course on stigma wasn't going to attract the people who really needed to attend, and running a course wouldn't necessarily do it anyway. So we just kind of flipped the thinking around, and I know this has been happening everywhere really now anyway, to look at how we could do it differently and reach people. And I guess the other thing that we realised was that we didn't own stigma and discrimination, that stigma and discrimination is something that is part of health settings across all different aspects of health. So it can be about the experience of injecting drug users in the health system. It can be people who are living with obesity. It can be about age. It can be about gender. There's so many experiences people can have about that are around stigma and discrimination, be they people using health services or people working within them. So what we thought we could do was try and work across the local health district to make some kind of inroads to celebrate diversity. And as a result of that, we had a festival of inclusion, and that work, the build of that work, that was like the impetus to start the work, to kind of highlight it in the local health district. We were working with people from drug and alcohol, from the consumers group, from mental health, from the obesity service, from youth health, from, right across the local health district, the disability teams. And the idea was to get everyone on board to have this festival of inclusion, so to give highlight to the resources available to staff within the local health district, to celebrate diversity, to launch some new resources, to kind of just give a general focus for a week. And from there, that group grew into the Inclusion Collaborative, which has been an ongoing group who meet to look at diversifying and creating further work in that area. So there have been two festivals of inclusion, and the work continues today.
What are you looking forward to most in retirement, and what will you miss?
I'll miss the people. I am, missing the people. I miss the people, and I think missing the engagement as well. It's not that I can't be engaged with things. It's easy for me to be engaged with other things, but I miss engagement with the sector, with the content, with the work, with problem solving. And what I'm looking forward to is swimming in all the ocean pools and all the rock pools of Sydney. What I'm looking forward to is just having time and not having to kind of, to just sit and breathe and read and be quiet and unfill my diary. I don't know that that will ever happen, and maybe it's not important that it does, but to have a sense of spaciousness, that's what I'm looking forward to.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for interviewing me, Tom.
You've been listening to the Sydney Sexual Health Centre podcast, where I've been interviewing Bronwyn Leese about her diverse career in health promotion and some of the changes that she has seen over the years. To stay up to date with the latest information in sexual health, you can follow us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. The links are in the description. And if you like the podcast, please share and subscribe.